Hello, everybody, and welcome to podcast number 11 of the Alexi Cell podcast. And my guest this week is the comedian Omid Jalili. And I'm very excited to have Omid with me. But also even more excited is my young man, Talal. You're always, you never know when I'm going to, drop you
bring
in.
Bring me in, yeah.
Bring you in or not.
You keep me waiting sometimes.
Yeah. He's very excited because of, well, because I can talk about what you mean to him, Omid. And I think the only two words of Farsi that I can say are salam and, Farsi and Nowruz.
Nowruz, yeah. New Year.
New Year. And
but Hudafez?
Hudafez.
That means
that's good.
Goodbye. Say that for the end. Hudafez.
The best one is Qiyafeh Jarkesh, which they often say to me, which means the look of a pimp, or the face of a pimp. I usually use that as a hashtag. Whenever I send something in the Persian language, I always a hashtag Qiyafeh Jarkesh, face of a pimp. People say I have a face of a pimp. So it's become a well-known hashtag now. Not that anyone needed to know that.
As is my wont with these podcasts, I've done no research on your career and I haven't had any thought about what we're going
to
talk about.
Don't need
but
to.
Let's, we can start at, well, we can start at the beginning. The most important thing is how obviously you relate to me. So I think we first met on that weird Rob Brydon show.
Yes, yes.
Historically Retentive or something it was called.
Annually Retentive.
Annually Retentive.
That's right. And I think the point was we were in the makeup chair talking about Czechoslovakian experimental theatre.
Yes.
Because I had lived there for 5 years and then you were talking about your knowledge of it and I was talking about the experimental centre, the theatre of experimental theatre in Brno in Czech Republic. And we were off and we were kind of ignoring him.
Yeah.
He was the host. I remember that.
And then I've mentioned Hafez the Great.
Yes, we did.
Persian poet, and then you quoted,
We did because I lived in the former Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a story I told you about my first piece of theatre where I was involved with a Czechoslovak theatre company and the first thing I did was walk on stage in darkness and a goldfish on a string came from the top of the theatre with a tight pin spot with someone playing one note on a cello at the back. And it just comes down and then general cover comes up lights and I've got a gun and I click and there's an explosive device and the fish explodes and it has water in it. And then I shout Lenin at the top of my voice and there was a blackout and a standing ovation. And I, to this day, I have no clue what any of that meant, but it was very exciting.
The cruelties of communism are well documented, but I think the suffering that those audiences were put through, it's a different... We've got the suppression of Dubček and the Velvet River. Was this after communism or
during? Yeah, this is 1990-1991. It was after the Velvet. I was there knocking bits of the wall down in Berlin in 89, and then everyone said there's a Velvet Revolution.
So we can't really blame. Well, we can probably blame communism for that.
Awful theatre, yeah.
Yes, but that show was also. There was a young Sharon Horgan, I think, was in it.
Yes, Rob. She was Rob's sidekick.
Yeah. And actually, there was like a cod. I thought it was very funny what we did, the improvisation. But for some reason, there was like a cod game show that he was involved in. And they mostly filled up the show with that, really, which was just really boring.
It was very strange. It was meant to be like the Larry Sanders show where you have the chat show, then you see the stuff going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But the actual game show that he was doing was actually that the producers liked the game show. So he was fighting with the producers. They said, the game show is good, let's play the game show. He goes, no, it's meant to be behind the scenes. Yeah. But we played the game, and it actually wasn't a bad game show.
No, it wasn't, but that kind of wasn't the point, really, was it?
No.
It was just stupid. Anyway.
But the thing for me, the big thing, a connection with me is that I could not believe seeing you in an audience when I did my first show at the London Palladium in 2006. It was a show called No Agenda, which we recorded. And my manager, who is, I never trust him because he has very bad eyesight. He's kind of partially blind. And he kept telling me, Alexei Sale is in the audience. And I said, he can't be. He goes, he is. He goes, are you sure it's not like a cousin? Because we have a kind of superficial, I'm sure it's a cousin. He goes, I'm 100% sure. And by the way, this is a manager who, I mean, he can see you if you're like 5 feet away. I mean, recently he went to a party and he always voice texts me if he's with celebrities. He'd say, Omid, you got to get here. I'm with Idris Elba. I said, what, from Luther? He goes, yeah. So I texted him, what's he like? And he texted back saying, sorry, it was Moira Stewart. And when I got there, it was Diane Abbott. I mean, that is how blind, that's how blind he is. So I didn't accept that you were in the, but then I saw you in the audience.
Yeah,
I don't know how you came or who invited you.
I can't remember.
But it was
it was a great show. It was a fantastic show. I was, I'm a notorious ligger, you know, people don't. I demand, you know, goodie bags. Everybody, you know, it was me and there was that terrible old, rattled old roué, Nicky Haslam. Do you remember? It was kind of figure on the, just some terrible facelifted old.
Bastard. What, on the circuit?
He was just some socialite. I think he's dead now, but he may not be. I don't know. He was just somebody who was around. I don't know why I went off on talking about him, really. I thought, you know, sometimes you reach for something. You think, you know, you start improving something and you think it's going to pay off.
You just bailed out of your own improv.
Yeah, and it doesn't, and that didn't really. I used to have a column in the Independent, I think, and I was talking. Do you remember do you remember ES magazine in the Standard? And when it first started, it was really amazing magazine. It had Brian Sewell writing about cars.
Yeah, Brian Sewell. I lived
Brian
with him.
Brian Sewell.
So and, posh,
and what was he called? There was a bloke. I don't think he was called Douglas Carswell, but he was a gay travel writer who basically just wrote about cottaging and stuff every week. And I remember once he went to a flirting class for and the woman asked him with women, and the woman asked him why he was there, and he said, because I'm sick of cock. Anyway, so that was ES magazine, was really interesting in the early days. Then it changed and became this magazine about the, which it probably still is, about the kind of aristocrats and the children of aristocrats and stuff. And I said it also had a column in it by a rattled old roué called Nicky Haslam. And then he wrote something insulting about me in the Standard, I guess. And then it was looking like it was going to be, I remember his response to me was published, but on September the 10th, 2000, when was the Twin Towers? It was the day before. 2001, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, you know, we could have got a proper feud going, but it was, we're talking about events.
It's like rappers.
That's funny you mentioned go on, tell us.
So it's like rappers having a beef. I like that.
Yeah, columnists.
It's interesting that the whole flirting class, because I actually remember I used to make Brian Sewell laugh because he lived near me, near my parents' home in Kensington. I used to walk past him and then we started chatting. This is years ago. And I think we were talking. He goes, now you're an Arab, aren't you? I said, no, I'm Iranian. I said, but I do. He goes, but when you do that thing on stage, it's like an Arabic guy. I said, I do a generic Middle Eastern. And we started talking. For some reason, this is really random. We started talking about pickup lines. I was talking about Arab pickup lines. And it was ridiculous. Things like, baby, you know, one night with me, you'll break up like the Starship Enterprise at Warp 9. And all this stuff. And he goes, this is great. I guess I'd say, baby, you had two choices. The one he goes, that's very good. Do you have any more? This is great. And I said, sometimes I get myself, my English side comes out. And I come a big, like, baby, do you want a gin and tonic or a small flat in Mayfair? Like a small flat in Mayfair. I said, well, actually, my uncle's there at the moment and it's very untidy. Give it 2 weeks. Maybe you can sleep on the bottom bunk and give it. Do you know what? Let's forget the whole thing. So I remember talking pickup lines with Brian Sewell. He was just most amusing. He was so posh.
He wasn't, because people, I mean, he was, he could be, since we're talking about Brian Sewell, we can carry on, I think. Because I remember a young producer, I think Bruce Hyman later. He he wanted
Bruce
to get
Hyman,
me.
Bruce Hyman.
Bruce Hyman, yeah.
Mr. Sewell, baby, one night with me and your pussy will look so beat up, it looked like terrorist number 3 in Zero Dark 30. Sorry, Karen, you can cut
yeah,
that.
Anyway, yeah, it's probably so anyway, this, he got me together with, he wanted to do a chat show where me and Brian Sewell would talk about things, and we'd have tremendous rows, and we had a chat, and we agreed on absolutely everything, really. It was very
you and Brian Sewell, you agreed on everything of that guy?
More or less, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
He said my car was the finest car ever made, the Rover P5B Coupe.
Amazing.
And we couldn't. So that show was a non-starter.
That's interesting. You struck up a good friendship with someone you never thought you'd be. That's the thing about you. I mean, everyone thinks you're like a hardened kind of Scouse Marxist, and there you are with a kind of Kensington effete kind of critic. You to get on so well. That's great.
Got on really. Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's why just know people who are like you. It's like it's what's the point, really? I mean, sometimes Linda, I do bring some people home that Linda sort of says, "Nah, that's
actually
you can't bring Tommy Robinson home or whatever." But no. I mean, I think I like people who I don't mind people who disagree with me. Really,
I think it's great. I think it was it. Forgive me if I'm quoting it wrong, but I think Brian Sewell had a short career. I think he even reviewed some comedy. He was mostly an art critic.
Yeah.
But I think he went to the festival one year. Correct. Do your research. But I think there was a review he wrote. He saw a comedian. I think it was his first review. Tell me if you've heard this story. I'm not sure. The first review was sitting in this theater. I see placards on the wall of all the famous writers who've had their work performed on this very stage. Placards read William Shakespeare, Christopher Marlowe, and David Mamet. My eyes fall upon one placard, which sums up everything that I saw on stage tonight. The placard reads, "Disabled Toilet." I think that was Brian Sewell. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. Well, he could be a sayback. He wasn't. He was. He didn't. He didn't suffer fools gladly.
And neither do you. And by the way, one of the reasons why, first of all, I was so upset to see that some Tory twat was trying to cancel you, and I Stand With Alexis L became a big hashtag. So I jokingly said, no one tries to cancel my dad. And it was all this kind of stuff. Oh, even though we don't have that much of a difference in our age. But I was always very moved on Annually Retentive. You said if there was ever a biopic of your life, that I play maybe one part of it.
Yeah.
And I was always very moved by that. And I have an apology to make to you because quite a few years ago, this is before you supported my film, We Are Many, which was about the anti-war demonstrations, which I helped produce with Amir Amirani. I had a ending to one of my shows. And when you're in your 40s, you think everything is funny. You think everything is hysterical. And I can't quite remember the chronology of it, but there was a routine I was doing that became a running gag. It was about how Iranians like to watch television playing with their balls. And they often twist their ball sack once, twice, three times to the point it's about to snap, and they let it go and there's a brrr sound, it goes round. And it became a funny show. And my dad had said to me, I'd love to be in one of your shows. I said, you know what? Well, we've got this ending where I've got Martin Sohn to make a prosthetic penis. And why don't you come out at the end and you open up this raincoat, we reveal this prosthetic penis that you twist it, then when you let it go, it spins around 6 times. And my dad looked at me and said, he was laughing. He said, sorry, what do you mean? He said, well, I want you to come on at the end. And he was so offended. He got up and he said, I can't believe you asked me. What kind of son are you? How dare you? Do you not see I'm a respectable man? Do you think I would get up and do this on stage? You got another thing coming. I would recommend you drop the idea and forget. And I just thought, oh, he's being stupid. So then I had lunch with you. And I stupidly said, Alexi, I would love to use you. And he said, go on. I was telling you the thing. You were laughing. Go on, go on. And I'd like you to come on with this pathetic. And you just went, no, I'm not going to do that. And I think the lunch finished. And I was so embarrassed. And I told my dad, he goes, you asked Alexi? And I'd be surprised if Alexi ever talks to you again. That man is a hero. And that's it. If you ever thought about playing him in a film, it's gone. It's finished. And he berated me so much. So I apologized to him, and I have to publicly apologize to you that even the thought, and then, but you know what? I got the guy who made the prosthetic penis do it. And he did it at the end of a very good show, and the whole bit died. And everyone walked out saying, that was a good show, but what's that book at the end? They let a janitor on, and from at the Hammersmith Apollo, it looked like a real penis. He twisted it, and it span around six times. And everybody was shocked and disturbed and very upset with this. And people thought, what the hell was that? And I think the review, I lost a star. I got a 3-star review when it could have been a 4. What could have been a 3-star review got became a 2-star review. It was like everything was ruined, and I had paid £1,000 to make a prosthetic penis with an electric motorized spinner, and we'd spent hours on this. And so I want to apologize that I was young and stupid. I mean, this is only 5 or 6 years ago, but I want to apologize publicly apologize. And I'm so relieved that you that you're talking to me now.
Well, thank you. It was certainly, I was never going to.
The most unusual.
Yeah.
It was the most unusual request.
It was certainly,
ever had.
I didn't know. I didn't know.
Especially, I think I hadn't even mentioned a financial fee. I think I just thought, as a mate, would you do this?
And
I think there was no. Even if I've offered you £20,000, you wouldn't have done that.
No. I wouldn't. No. Yeah.
Just looking at your face now, we can see each other. Yeah. And you're smiling, but you're still disturbed.
Yeah.
That a younger comedian would ask you, that the temerity.
It wasn't, no, I wouldn't say that exactly. But it's just something I think about quite a lot. Yeah, I have to say. Obviously, I do, you know, I love you and I think you're great. But, you know, it is something that it does come into my mind from time to time. I can't pretend that it didn't.
I know, and it's really embarrassing. Do you know what? It's one of those, you know, when you walk down the street and you suddenly hit your head. It was one of those, you're one of those moments that I actually even asked you to do that. So thank you. Thank you for being kind.
You're very welcome.
Talk about a goodie bag. I'm hung up on the technicality, because is it the penis that spins or the testicles? I don't want to talk too long about it, but.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing.
So I want to try this when I'm watching.
We had a real, because the first model was the penis went round, but actually I just wanted the balls to spin round.
Because that's the authentic way, the Iranian way.
Yeah, is it right? So, okay. But whatever it was dumb, it was stupid, and I'm glad I can have a catharsis on this podcast. You may even cut this whole bit. I wouldn't blame you. But if it crosses your mind now and again, please accept my wholehearted apology.
That's all right. I mean, I think it's probably, I mean, it's, you say, it's, you know, the stand-up is all about trying stuff. I would say, you know, we try and make this a bit of a workshop. Pretend to make this a workshop for young comedians. I think the prop comedy is, if when you're tempted to do a prop, probably don't really, I think. Is that the lesson you take from that? Or
It was definitely a lesson I learned, that prop comedy will certainly not top a really good stand-up show.
Yeah.
It's not, because I think the lesson here is comedians are always looking for an amazing ending. I mean, I work a lot with Boothby Graffo, and he did a show where he had a collapsible kitchen. So they spent a lot of time. He spoke in front of a curtain, and then for the second half of the show, he introduced his kitchen, which then collapsed over the next 20 minutes. There were things he introduced, and then the whole thing moved, and it was a big thing. And if you're going to use props, it has to be very funny and worth it. And I think that at the end of the day, a really good gag would have been better than doing something. So that was a big lesson I learned.
Yeah, and I can remember now. I remember Rick Mayall playing a big theatre in Edinburgh, I guess during the festival, and he came on in I think it was a rabbit costume and got a huge laugh. But then he was stuck in front, he was stuck in the fucking costume.
Yes.
For the rest of the show, and he'd lost all authority by the end because I'm saying this as a tip really, a funny costume is the same thing as a prop in a way that you can become a prisoner of it, I think. And it really scared, you know, Rick, you can't intimidate hecklers if you're dressed as a rabbit. I think it was
funny though.
It was funny at first, and if he was only doing a 5-minute bit, but then if you're stuck in dressed as a fucking rabbit for an hour, you're fucked, really.
That happened actually when I hosted Live at the Apollo and Julian Clary was on, and he said to me, I just said to him, how would you like me to introduce you? And he said, could you introduce me as the biggest homosexual in the UK? And I said, what's the joke? He goes, well, I'm coming on in stilts. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So it'd look offensive, but then I'll come on. That's the gag. So I said, okay, ladies and gentlemen, please really welcome the biggest homosexual. He came through and he was on stilts, and there was a huge laugh. And then, of course, he had to come down from the stilts. Yeah. And then he lost it took 2 minutes. It took 2 minutes. And then amazingly, I'm sure we can talk about this because the way they fixed it in the edit was remarkable. He was supposed to do 25 minutes. I think there was about 10 minutes on the clock and he hadn't got the audience laughing. And he walked off stage, and at the Apollo, there's a door on the side in the audience where you can just escape and then leave the whole building. So he got up and left, and there was no one on stage. And I said to his manager, is that it? And he said, yes, I think so. I said, he's supposed to do 25. He goes, yes, he was. Is he coming back? Is he no. I said, do you think I should go on? He was, I think you should. So I went on and I said, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. That was Julian Clary. And there was a weird round of applause. But in the edit, they fixed it. So you see, as I walk on, he's walked off. They've got him walking off that way. But that was the lesson. He lost the audience for 2.5 minutes. So that was a big lesson.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's, I mean, I didn't know we were going to go there, but it genuinely is. That is a lesson, I suppose, that you learn that yourself, yeah, and either props or complex costumes.
It's so stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you're a good stand-up. Now, the reason that this is important for young comedians to listen to this now is that you are by far, you know, there was a great discussion on Twitter about the I Stand with Alexei Sale, and someone said, there are not many comedians who are, you know, supporting this. And I said, well, if there aren't, there should be, because without Alexei, we wouldn't have a career. And I know when you started around, was it 79? I think it was. I think you once said to me, we didn't even know what it was. A reviewer didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When you started doing stand-up, you must have known what it was. And did you have, because you've done lots of films in America, did you go to America and see stand-up? Was it something, or was it just something that was so organic? You just started doing something and it became stand-up.
Yeah, I just had the vaguest. I had no real fixed idea of what it was. I didn't have any comedy records. I didn't, you know, I listened to comedy, but just the stuff that was on the radio. I think I saw the Richard Pryor film, first two Richard Pryor films before. And then I saw the Dustin Hoffman film, Lenny.
Oh, yeah, the black and white one.
Yeah, 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 which again is, okay. And that's all. And I had a vague idea of like Lenny Bruce and what he did. And but it was very, I think because I only had a vague idea of what a kind of left-wing cabaret comic would be, I was free to kind of reinvent it, really, you know, to invent it just invent it as a completely original art form. And it's, you know, what happened in Britain is very different, I think, to what happened in the States, really. So, yeah, I mean, I think it gives you freedom, really. If you don't, I think one of the things that must be difficult for young comics now is that everything is available, really. And you'll have especially when you're young, you'll have no original ideas, but it doesn't matter because you just plow through them until you start having original ideas. But I think now, I mean, I'd do a bit and think, oh, that's a bit like the Pythons, but I couldn't check because it wasn't available, yeah. You know, without going into, you know, going getting a job for the BBC and going into the film library and then signing out in triplicate, you know, the film and then looking at it on a Steenbeck machine. I couldn't look at the Python. So I was just free to do, and through that I evolved my own style. But now I think when everything that you're doing, something like it that somebody else has done is available, I think, I wonder whether that paralyzes young comics in a way.
But you still have a similar, so as a young, in quotes, comic, you still have a similar problem today, though, because it's hard to cross-check everything because there is so much now. So there might not, everything's pretty much been done, sure, but like I can't Google every joke or song that I write.
Well, then that's good. That's a good thing.
It is good. But what I think is still easy to be unique is your personality. that's what you have to rely on, is your character has to be.
It's always, it's yeah, always the person. It's always, it's 95% your perspective. Personality. But the question I had for you, Alexi, do you remember your first gag?
My first gag?
Or the first, like how you would open?
Well, it sort of evolved really, because I didn't, you know, first of all, I was doing this, there was me and this other guy in this kind of double act, really, and we had a 45-minute, hour-long show, and where I would step out and talk to the audience. Now, what was it? I think it was, yeah, the sort of first thing, yeah, I said directly to the audience was, I'm not a violent person, but I just keep getting fucking provoked, which kind of set the template for the
scene. That's brilliant.
Yeah. I think, that's just come to me now, yeah. So I'm not a violent person. I just get fucking provoked. And then it was that routine about the sort of, it was about a bloke who, like a Scouse bloke who kept getting involved in fights about philosophy, you know.
That's it. Yes.
Yeah, that routine, which is what I auditioned for the Comedy Store with. And That
just got more and more. I remember because it was you almost like fighting with yourself, wasn't it?
Just fighting with the woman in the cake shop, and like, yeah, just. That was probably my first line. Yeah, first kind of comedic line.
Because that's fantastic. Because when I first worked with you on your, was it Alexis Sells merry-go-round?
Of course, that's right.
Yeah, I think that's the first time we met, and I was Mr. Papadopoulos, a kind of Greek kebab shop owner.
Yeah,
I remember that. But it's interesting. Even though you are from Liverpool, I saw you as a kind of ethnic minority comedian. I remember thinking, this guy's like me. It's such an honor to work with him, and he's part Russian because I've got some Russian background as well, and he's a bit like me. And
the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me. I think that is the best fucking thing that anybody's ever said, that you saw me as a minority ethnic comedian.
I thought you were a minority. I honestly thought he's Russian. He's a Scouser, but there's an angry energy which is ironic. That was a thing that I loved. It was all so ironic. So that routine of you fighting a Scouse guy. Scousers are very funny, by the way, because my wife's family are Scousers. They're always, you know, they've always got lines, haven't they?
Yeah.
Omid's funniness is like is legendary, and by legendary I mean it's a myth. It's like the Loch Ness monster. It's like the Loch Ness. Everyone's heard of it, but nobody's seen it. It's all stuff like that. So when I saw you, I really connected with it. And I never saw you at the Comedy Store, unfortunately, but those must have been electric nights when the Comedy Store when it was at Leicester Square. Is that
the... Yeah, it wasn't even at Leicester Square. This was that was only the being a historical bore. Now, the original Comedy Store was in Mead Street in Soho.
Was that where
off
it was? Where it was
Wardour
a strip
Street,
club, yeah.
Corner of Mead Street and Wardour Street. That was the original Comedy Store, I think you'll find, and really the only authentic one. And, of course, the one in Leicester Square and then the one now that Don's got is entirely lacking in authenticity. And the autograph of Robin Williams on the photo was actually done by Peter Rosengard. Robin Williams never signed that. I invented everything. Me. Sorry.
I met Robin Williams in New York, and I was doing a show with Whoopi Goldberg at the time, and so the owner said, "Oh, Robin Williams has dropped in. Can I introduce you?" And he said, "Hey, Robin, can I introduce you to?" And I realized he'd forgotten my name, so I said, "Actually, I'm." And then he went, "No, I know you. I know you." And he hugged me. He hugged me, and he said, "You honestly," and he was like saying, "Honestly, you are so funny. I've been watching you for years. I think you're brilliant. People don't talk about you enough." And I thought, I said, "Sorry, who do you think?" He went, "It's Alexi." He thought I was you. He goes, "Alexi." But the good thing was I let him speak, and he was going on about how you're such a hero for him. And I was going to ask, did you know him at all?
Never met him. Yeah, yeah.
Never met him, but he was aware of you.
I did. No,
oh, you
I did? No.
Okay.
No, in fact, I did his, I mean, you know, I did a couple of obituary things when he died. I had a period when I knew him. I mean, this is in the Comedy Store, yeah, which was in this strip club in Soho. And
did he drop in? Did he drop
yeah,
in?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd just been. He wasn't well known because Mork and Mindy was shown in Britain, but it was shown at 10 o'clock in the morning because they thought it was a kid's show. Yeah. I think it was shown on ITV. And so most people didn't know who he was. He wasn't a big star. But I used to do the running order. And so I'd stand at the bottom of the stairs. People would come in and say, I'd say, you know, who are you? What are you doing? I'll put you on, you know, whenever. And this guy with dyed blonde hair came and he said, sure, can I go on tonight? And I was like, yeah, what's your... It was Robin. So
what year was that? 81, 82?
He was making his first big movie, which was Popeye, directed by Robert Altman. I mean, not a great film, really. But so he'd been in Malta filming this for like 3 months, presumably without... Because, you know, he was compulsive about doing stand-up. So he'd changing planes in London. He got in a cab, said to the cabbie, take me to the Comedy Store. And, of course, he was lucky, really. He must have got a hip cabbie because then there were no, you know, Comedy Store was the only comedy club in Britain. He was lucky he didn't take him to the Circus Tavern Pearfleet, you know, where he'd be on with fucking Jim Davidson. So he turned up. And I said, yeah, of course, I'll put you on. And I put him on, and he did 45 minutes or something.
You're kidding me.
Astonishing material. And then he used to turn up at the comic strip quite regularly and do 45 minutes an hour. And then when I was in LA, and I talk about my failed, when you listen to my Desert Island Discs, I talk about my failed time in Hollywood. But I saw Robin a few times. When
I have to ask you about all that. But I saw Robin Williams collapse on stage. As in the sharpest comedy mind, he had a moment which was extraordinary because we were doing Prince Charles's 60th birthday party. You know, I think it was 2007 or 2008. And there was a bunch of us went to practice our sets in a small club in Kingston called Outside the Box. It was a tiny club, 60-seater, and the owner... Well, the comedy club, the MC, a guy called Math Brown, was saying, "Sir, please would you welcome Omid Jalili?" And they said, "Okay, please would you welcome Al Murray?" And they couldn't believe it. "Please would you welcome Joe Brand?" And there were like all these massive people. So we can't believe we had these people. He goes, "And now to finish, please would you welcome Robin Williams?" And they went, "Oh, come on." And Robin Williams just came with 60 people in a tiny club.
Fuck.
The place went nuts. They were standing up. And as it all died down, he went, "Thank you, thank you. Hey, how are you doing?" And someone in the front row just went, "Flubber." And he went, "What did you say?" He went, "You were in Flubber, weren't you?" He went, "What? What? Are you, what?" And then he had this real wobble for about a minute and he didn't know what to do. He just walked around. He goes, "Why did you say that?" He goes, "Just say you're in the film Flubber." He goes, "Yeah, but why would you mention that film?" And he went, "Anyway, forget about it." But he had this real moment. It took him a good minute to recalibrate. And then I saw him at the theatre, which is the Wimbledon Theatre where we're doing it. We were doing practice runs. And I said, "What happened to you?" He goes, "I just thought of all the things. I'm Robin Williams. Of all the films, you mentioned that piece of shit.
Yeah.
I lost my shit. He goes, and he genuinely had a moment. It really hurt his ego. Why couldn't you mention Good Morning Vietnam? Why couldn't you mention? He went through all these films.
Yeah,
but God love him. He was a very sweet man. I mean, did you get on with him or did you spend?
We were friends really. I mean, I think in a way, you know, for a while. He's the only US comic I've ever been friendly with, really. And he I've only subsequently read, you know, obviously read the, you know, the things he went through. He seemed to calm down in the sort of 90s, really, a bit. I just really admired him as a comic. I mean, I think it's just what comics do. I had to, because it seemed like magic at first what he was doing, and I was lucky that I got a chance to look at him over and over again until I figured out what he was doing, really.
Okay, what was he doing?
The trick. What he did was that he had I think, about 3 or 4 hours of material, and what he would do was he would rotate it, really. He wasn't making anything up. It was all gear. But this is another lesson for comedians, I suppose. It was all material, but he would rotate it in his head. So he would go in a certain direction. But it had all been, because I would finally, after watching him obsessively for hours, I saw the same bit coming round again, and I thought, oh, that's how you're doing it, you know. And in a way, that was more satisfying to me once I'd worked out what he was doing. It was when I just thought it was kind of magic. I was kind of disturbed once I worked it out. I was really.
We become disturbed with comedians and become obsessed with them. What are you doing? How do you do that?
Yeah,
I got a bit like that with him, because there was a show after that show for the 60th birthday. He did a private show. It was a fundraiser for the Prince's Trust, and what he did, I saw the show. He did the show, and then there was half an hour of questions he took. And as a comic, you know that if someone says something and it's hit a subject where he's got a bit on. But then there were a couple of things that happened that showed lightning quick.
Yeah.
And then he just went, whoa. He goes, I better write that down. And
it was quick as well, yeah.
He was very quick.
Yeah.
So that I will give him that he had an amazing, amazingly sharp mind.
Well, I'll tell you this, but he was the most, I mean, I don't really know that many comics, but he's the most compulsive comic. I don't know whether it's in my book. I think it probably is, but I'll tell it anyways now, since we're talking about it, was that, He turned up at the Comedy Store one night, a comic strip, and he said, can I go on? I said, well, we were filming the comic strip movie or something, so if we went past midnight, we went into horrendous overtime. So I said to him, well, yeah, you can go on, but you can only do 15 minutes because otherwise it'll cost us a fortune, which gave me tremendous pleasure, I have to say, to fuck him around. And he said, okay, he said, I'll buy the club. He said, do you guys own the club? Because I'll buy it. And I said, no, you know, it's owned by some pornographer. It was owned by Paul Raymond. And he said, well, I've got, you know, like Mick Jagger and Dustin Hoffman and, you know, fucking Pelé are in the audience to see me. And I said, I don't, you know, again, as Flaubert says, inside every revolutionary, there's a policeman. So I was going, no, mate, I can't. You can only do your 15 minutes. I don't care who's in the audience. I'm fair enough. Fair enough, he only did 15 minutes. And then this absolutely has got truth. He did the other 45 minutes to me by myself in a fucking corridor. He had me backed up against the wall, and he did 45 minutes of stand-up to me.
Was he pretending it was a conversation, or was it?
No, he just did it. He couldn't not do it. He had to do it.
That's compulsive.
Wow. Yeah, he just did it. I was fine. I mean, you know,
there were some people like that, actually. I know with Jimmy Carr used to be a bit like that. But with Jimmy, if you tell him, Jimmy, we're just having a conversation, can you stop trying your bits? He goes, okay, sorry.
And
But Robin wouldn't even do that. He just had to do his material.
Yeah, I think you couldn't stop him, really. It was very... it was very compulsive. I mean, you know, fine, but I didn't mind, you know.
But how did you find Hollywood, Alec? I've always wondered, because
you've been much more successful than me, I have to say.
Not necessarily. We've both become kind of bit part specialists. Yeah. I was actually thinking of doing a show, you know, inside the actor's studio where you've got James Burton. I'm trying to write a script called Inside the Ethnic Bit Part Actors Studio. I just get lots of bit part actors and talk to them like with the kind of high level kind of respect.
That's brilliant.
But yeah, but when was your first? Because my first one was The Mummy. When was your first Hollywood?
My first movie was Gorky Park, where I played a Russian, which would be 1982, 1983, something like that.
Wow.
That was probably the high point, really. I think it was pretty much downhill.
Gorky Park was a great film.
It was a good film, yeah. Yeah, and I was good in it as well. I think I've been good in some shit films. I don't think I've ever been... I don't think I've ever been... What would be the... I don't think I've ever been bad in a good film, but I haven't been in many particularly good films. I've done some terrible films, really. One of the things when people kind of respect you, they kind of forget the odd the odd blot on your escutcheon, like Carry On Columbus. But I would now, looking back, ascribe my relative failure as an actor. I mean, you've taken it much more seriously and had much more, done a lot more movies and a lot better movies, I think.
No, I was lucky. I was very lucky, actually.
Well, I think you worked hard as well, though, haven't you? You've done theatre.
I've always taken acting very seriously, and now with so much identity politics going on, that I think people are upset that I played retrospectively. That I played a couple of Jews. They weren't happy. I played Fagin. They weren't happy that I played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, and I wasn't really big on musicals anyway. But it was, you know, I'm the kind of person that thinks variety is a spice of life. Mm. But I do remember, and I was telling Talal this. I do remember that it was a conscious decision to do these films, because when I was offered one role, I'll never forget it. The first one was The Mummy, and I went into the audition and they literally made me read three pages of dialogue where I only had like two lines. And I had to wait. Lots of other people were reading. And then I said my one line. Then I said my one line. They go, okay, that's great. Let's do it again. But here's a couple of notes. And I said, wait, you're going to give me notes? They went, yeah. I said, but I've only read two lines. He goes, let's do it again. But I said, no. There's, you don't give notes. It's written. I mean, I've done two-dimensional characters, but this is not even one-dimensional. And it's actually, frankly, offensive. And they said, well, what do you recommend? So I said, look, let's put the thing away. And I started doing bits of my act. I was doing things like the fatwa on Salman has been lifted, but on behalf of all Iranian dyslexics, we'd like to apologize for the death of Willy Rashton. Willy Rashton was an accident waiting to happen. And I just started rolling with it. And they said, okay, we'll give you the part there and then. And then they said, nothing we've written is any good. So why don't you just improvise? 9 times out of 10 will tell you it doesn't work, but don't be like a sensitive actor, have a thick skin. And that's what would happen. I just threw stuff out and then they cut what they thought was the best stuff. But they often sometimes said, don't do that. And I thought, well, that's funny. I'll do it again. Then I do it again. They go, oh, that's really funny. Because I realized, I think these people don't know what they want. They were so dismissive of a brown actor being funny that I felt that when I did it, I should just keep writing stuff for it. So they'll get the credit for it, but it doesn't matter. Every day before the scene, I think, okay, what can I do here? And it wasn't about stealing the scene. It was about doing something funny that they could possibly do.
Right.
So it was a conscious decision to get involved, basically to stop them being one-dimensional. And I was able, and I apologize to any Arab or Egyptian actors, I was able to make it two-dimensional at least, because what they had was nothing on the page.
Right.
So it was a conscious decision to do it. So when you say I was hardworking, I felt I was doing something for my people. I think that's probably why.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, fair play to them for actually, it's a good movie as well, The First Mummy, isn't it? It's a decent film.
I have a very close connection with that film, with The Mummy.
Yeah. Talal, you did voices for it, didn't you?
Yeah, so my main income at the moment, well, has been for a long time, is doing ADR work, which is post-production background voices in films and television. And like, I can't tell you how many different things I've done voices for. And so for the first 15, 16 years of doing it, I've been doing it for 21 years since I was 12 years old. They thought I was like just I only ever did Arab stuff. They needed Arab voices for films. So the amount of times I've played Terrorist Number One, Terrorist Number Two, like just done their death sounds. Like, okay, this guy's about to get hit, blown up. We need the sound of we need someone saying death to America. And, you know, it's like, you just take the job. It's like, at least I'm doing it and not some non-Arab who's doing it, you know. And at least that, and during in the ADR sessions, it's all improvisation. So you have the power to like you did with The Mummy, but on a much smaller scale, to tweak what they're giving you and at least have some input.
And you think you're doing something good for your culture.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But I have to tell you, Alexei, as well. Alexei, what happened in my career at the beginning was when I was doing small gigs, I often get taken to one side by the owner. They say, come backstage, I want to talk to you. He goes, you're great. Thing is, I can't recommend you. I can't wait because I don't know your name. Who goes, I've seen a great act. What's his name? I don't remember. You need to change your name, change the publicity, get yourself a turban, pantaloons, curly toe shoes, call yourself, I swear to God, he goes, call yourself Ali Baba, the Sultan of Comedy. You get a lot of work that way, mate. Get a lot of work. And the thing was, the guy who said that to me was in Southend and he saw me 10 years later. I saw him outside the BBC. He goes, what are you doing here? I said, just doing a show. He goes, what are you doing? I didn't want to say it's my own show. I said, just doing a show. It's BBC. What's it called? He goes, yeah, it's called the Omid Djalili Show. He goes, Omid Djalili Show. I said, yeah. I said, do you remember when you said I should do pantomime? He goes, when was that? I said, you said that 10 years ago. It's taken you 10 years. Do you know what? If you listen to me, you've been here much quicker.
For fuck's sake.
You would have been here much quicker, mate. And do you know what? He has a point. Maybe it would have, if I had kind of pandered to that thing, and I kind of thought I already was pandering a bit, but that, I think that was the perception that Ali Baba, the Sultan of comedy, I would have got ahead much quicker.
But at what cost? But
my
ADR work has, you know, I've got to take part in lots of really cool things I'm proud of, but my very first film in 1999, I was 12 years old, was The Mummy.
Oh, you're kidding.
And I got to play loads of kids' voices. Like, wherever you see a child running around in the background, it's either me or one of my mates doing the voice of them selling stuff at the market, or, you know, shouting and like playing football in the background, I think, in one scene. And my mum is actually that did voices in that too. And she's, you get like a bit handsy with some women in burkas and they all kick you out of the shop. My mum voiced one of them, those women kicking out of the
That's
shop.
That's incredible. And by the way, they cut the best line of all time, where they just had me being thrown out of a shop, hit and smacked, and I'm going,
yeah.
And then I say, most women thank me for doing that. And that got cut. I thought that was a good line.
That's great. And you can imagine for a 12-year-old how exciting it was to work on something like that. They took us over to Pinewood Studio and like recorded all the, or it could have been
amazing.
Shepperton or something. And then a few months later, I worked on a film called Arabian Nights, which Alexi was in.
With Alexi, yes.
And both of you played Arabs in both of those films.
Amazing. Yeah.
So I did want to ask you about playing Arabs in films, because obviously Alexi as well is the Sultan of Hatay
in
Indiana Jones. But Omid, so it's nice. And I'm grateful to you, Omid, for doing your best to represent properly. And you said, you know, you told me previously that you have a reason, you have a personal reason to want to represent, because you have some Arabic family and stuff as well.
I want to wrap it, but that's the thing. See, Alexi and I both know that if you have a good, if you're in a big movie and even a small part, I remember actually, I hate to drop a name here, but Robert Redford, when I was introduced to Robert Redford for doing a film, and it was Tony Scott, who's the brother of Ridley Scott, and you know, they've all got these Geordie accents. And he goes, yeah, Omid was in me brother's film, Gladiator. It's amazing, these big directors, he was in Gladiator. Yeah. And I said to Robert Redford, self-deprecating, I said, listen, I'm only in it for a few minutes. And he grabbed my arm. He goes, listen carefully. It's better to have a small part in a great movie than a big part in a piece of shit. He goes, I've done 7 movies where I played the lead part. 5 of those movies were never even cut together. 2 of the movies, I wish they'd never released them. So I learned that actually to be in a good movie, to have a small part in a really good movie is better than having a lead part in a terrible film.
Yes, it's true. Well, it's I suppose maybe the landscape has changed, but it's a big deal to be in a movie. But also I think I have to say, in a sense, that I represent a dark era. Being cast as an Arab
Well, how did you feel when that was offered to you, or when you were offered the audition?
I didn't really, you know. I think it was before you kind of thought, you know, you kind of, great, you know. Spielberg offered it to me. I wasn't going to turn it down.
It is an interesting one because I'm not even an Arab. You know, so in the sense, me and Alexi are the same. Neither of us are Arabs, but we've played Arabs because in those days, you take the work that you're given. But in the days now of identity politics, I'm not sure if I would do a role who was a well-known Jew. I'm not sure I would play. I certainly wouldn't play a black person. But no, I'm kidding. But I'm just saying that I would have to seriously think about the movie. How strong it is, what the message of the movie is, before I take even an Arab role. I don't know if you're the same, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't do a lot of acting these days, but I wouldn't. I don't think I would take a role now as an Arab, really.
Yeah, I think in general, I've made a real decision. You know, I was telling you, Talal, that most Middle Eastern people, we have 3 career paths, which are either, you know, medicine, law or social disgrace. And I've grabbed social disgrace with both hands. And I think that the most disgraceful thing I can do now, and the most, I suppose, the only thing with integrity is to be a stand-up. And I think that's where I'm focusing. I've almost given up an acting career as well.
Really?
It comes to that point where you realize, who am I? Why am I here? What impact can I make with the last few years of my life? I'm not interested in acting anymore.
Really?
Well, I'm not.
His Dark Materials and stuff like that.
Alexei, Dark Materials. I'm playing a character called Dr. Lancelius. The first day I tell the director, I said, before we start, just to say, I haven't read any of the books. He goes, don't worry. No. He goes, no, but I haven't even read the script. He goes, don't worry about it. I said, no, you don't understand. These other actors, I don't know who they are. He goes, you'll be fine. I said, I don't know who I am. I don't know anything about this. And then another actor grabbed me, James Cosmo. He goes, can I talk to you? And he goes, listen, no one understands this. Just speak in a low hum. Just keep it monotone and stay serious. And if you do it like that, you'll go. I said, fine. So everyone's just talking like this. Yeah. What are you going? So no one understands it. But I've done the odd bit. But in general, I think The Infidel was probably the last film, which is about a Muslim who finds out it's a Jew. Unless there's a point to it, unless there's making some kind of socio-political, geopolitical comment, I feel I can't get involved. I can't just do it for entertainment purposes. I don't know. Maybe you came to that decision a few years ago, Alexei. That's probably, I'm now getting to that point.
I am, except that this is what day are we? The 27th of May. I think on Saturday, I appear in BBC One's Casualty. Playing the homophobic father of
you are joking.
A Russian character, yeah.
No.
Russian.
Please Lev. Give us a bit. What's your accent?
Well, I kept saying to the directors, you all right with this? I think people would say, what's J.T. Belofsky doing in Casualty, really? This character is secretly gay, and I'm all like, we will go fishing and hunting together. Come back and live with me in Russia and leave your wife. It's all I'm doing like that.
Oh, hang on. So you're a gay character?
No, my son is gay.
Your son is gay. Okay.
Yeah. And has had that storyline. And in fact, he's actually an Israeli in real life, but he's playing a Russian. So it's a whole fucking stew of false fucking false identity, isn't it, really? He's not gay, and he's playing a Russian. And he's lovely. I really like him. He's very nice. A really interesting actor called Uriel Emery. And my family is Russian, so I suppose I can get away with it on that basis.
But did you do it just for the laugh? Is that
what? Yeah, because it was in lockdown, you know, and he's just trying anything to get out the house, really. I don't know what it's going to be like. Though. Okay, it's going to be fascinating because casual, you know. I mean, you must have done. Have you done Casualty, Holby?
I did The Bill. Have you ever been horrified by yourself? I've sometimes looked back.
Absolutely.
Or when have you been? Tell me when you've been horrified, please. You got to tell me.
Whenever it was, 1992, I signed on. I replaced Bea Arthur in The Golden Girls. She left. The other three old ladies bought a hotel called the Golden Palace.
Wow.
I was the wacky East European chef. So I signed a contract for 7 years to go to Hollywood to make this sitcom. And incidentally, the young black receptionist was Don Cheadle.
No.
You don't see that in this fucking CV. There was a little orphan boy called Jody. I mean, Jody didn't make it to the second day of rehearsals. I was like,
oh my God.
Where's Jody, man? Now Jody's been cut. You know, Jody's gone. Anyway, so I signed. So in between me signing this contract where I was going away for 7 years, never coming back, never ever coming back except as a big star to accept my Oscar or, you know, my BAFTA. Because I'd become such a success in the States. I got an offer to be in an episode of Lovejoy.
Right.
An episode of Lovejoy called Lovejoy and the Napoleonic Commode. And I thought, fuck it, yeah, I'm never coming back to Britain. So I decided to give this performance in Lovejoy and the Napoleonic Commode. I thought, fuck it, I'm never coming back. What does it matter? What kind of... I give the worst performance that anybody has ever fucking given in a...
No.
On British television. Check it out. It's often shown on ITV.
I'm going to write it down. What's it called?
It's called Lovejoy and Napoleonic Commode. And I play a sort of some sort of villain. It's about a toilet once owned by Napoleon. And I'm going, God blimey, Lovejoy! 20 grand for a cozy Lovejoy! And I'm just giving this, and I wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't, they'd taken you, tone it down a bit. And I'm like, fuck you, I'm going to be a big star in the States. God blimey, Lovejoy! God, you're buying a cozy Lovejoy! It's so fucking bad. It is so, it's such a terrible performance. And of course, I was, because they fired me, I was back in time to see it go out.
That's the. So how long did the sitcom Golden Palace last?
I lasted 2 weeks before they fired me. They fired me on my 40th birthday.
So and you didn't even finish an episode.
I did two episodes. And one of the young writers on it was the guy that Chuck Lorre, who later, you know, has done Big Bang Theory and that. He says that in my first recording, I got a standing ovation from the audience, which I don't remember, but they fired me anyway. I mean, Linda always thinks they cut me out of the episode. They reshot the episode.
Oh my God.
And replaced me with Cheech Marin. Linda thinks they probably wanted all along, that they were just using me to.
Oh my God!
You know, like that Louis episode where he's offered to replace Letterman, and in all the time it's just a plan to get somebody else's wages. I mean, they are so sneaky. I mean, you've got to admire. You know, I think those sitcom people then. Anyway, this was the 90s. They are so extraordinarily ruthless, you know.
Oh, completely. I do know that when we did the sitcom with Whoopi, they said they did 15 pilots that year, and only six were completed and edited, where some of them, they pulled the plug halfway through the whole thing. And even they were talking about doing a remake of Fawlty Towers, and they said, this is a great sitcom, we've got to do an American version, but one character we do not like is the character of Basil. That has to be a woman. Let's change that. So they even got rid of Basil Fawlty. It's amazing.
Yeah.
They are so ruthless and so, I mean, I did a whole series with, I completed 22 episodes. The show was canceled because of one joke, actually, which for posterity, I'm glad to tell you this. The story was, it was a hotel comedy, and 1 week we had, and Whoopi's a big Democrat, and she was warned not to do too many jokes about George W. Bush, and this was the straw that broke the camel's back. There was a hotel comedy, and two events were happening at the same time. There was a Republican meeting at the same time. There was a lesbian wedding, and guests would arrive saying, "We're here for the Bush event." So could you be more specific? And I'm glad that the show was cancelled. It was a good gag to go out on. But it was. But I remember thinking, I learned so. God, the things I learned. You know, like the word "extra" has many different things. It's not politically correct to call extras. No, you call them background artists. But in America, they're called atmosphere. Did you know? Were they
no,
called that?
I did not know. No.
Maybe when you're doing the Golden Palace, I thought they'd be doing that, because on our show, there's an atmosphere, could you move here? And they're taught not to converse with the actors. They're told not to even look you in the eye. So I stupidly went up to one of them. I said, "Hey, you guys, how do you feel about being called atmosphere?" And they're looking away. I said, "Hey, $20. Next time they call you atmosphere, I'll give $20 to anyone who says, 'Hey, it's ambiance to you.'" And they wouldn't even look at me. So there's a kind of industrial way they treat comedy. And actually, I think that's probably why Whoopi never did a second series. I mean, she was too wild and too, you know, she's too much her own woman to do. So I always respect people who've, like you, you've been thrown off a sitcom. I was fired from Pirates of the Caribbean. I always respect people like that, because it means there's something in you that's going against the big
exactly. Well, I think what it was with me was that I was so, that I desperately wanted to do it, but at the same time, there was a part of me that knew it was a terrible mistake. And so my behavior would be so contradictory that I would, I would just like go along with it for a couple of hours, and then I would just kind of freak out and say something the thing that certainly with American things is that what you have to have more than anything else, I always think, is a belief in the project that you should never undermine. But you have to be a believer in the project, you know, and that you have to show kind of your loyalty in all different ways. And Rue McClanahan had an allotment, and she used to leave like bags of tomatoes at the door of your dressing room, and then you were supposed to say, "Rue, those tomatoes, I made a salad with some oregano, and oh my god, I made a sauce, and I put it on, you know, with the tomato." I said, "Rue, I just threw them away. I'm staying in a hotel." I mean, that was my fate was sealed, I think, from that point. When I didn't, it wasn't my acting ability; it was my unwillingness to enthuse about Rue's tomatoes that really got me fired.
But I think that's interesting, actually, because it was very different working with a big global star like Whoopi, who's very political and very, like, she would often say to me, she'd scream at the writers and saying, "Ayatollah jokes, is that the best you got for this guy?" and she just kept saying, "I got your back, baby." And she kept saying things like, you know, brown people. It was all about brown people and black people, because you guys are like 30 years behind us black people. It's because you're kind of like the Richard Pryor of brown people. I said, "I'm nothing like Richard Pryor." "No, but you're one of the first people doing it. So we all look at Richard, and people are going to look at you, and we got to support you." And what happened was, she supported me with the writers. And I'll never forget this. This was, and you only go with instinct. When I look back, I can't say that I was politically motivated, or I was like, you know, a raging kind of angry political comic. But it got to a point where I didn't want to say the lines that they'd written for me. And I never forget, there's a guy called Larry Wilmore, who's a big star in America now. I think he's got his own show. He was the showrunner, and he was black. And he said to me, "I need to talk to you." And he goes, "You need to say the lines." And I just said to him, "I can't say these lines." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "A, they're not funny. B, they're slightly offensive. So let me play around with it." He goes, just say the damn lines. I said, "No. Would you like?" And I just said, "Would you say a line?" Goes, "Oh, massa. I'm home, oh, massa. Would you do that?" And he goes, "If it was in the script, I would." And we went nose to nose, and we had to be separated. And it wasn't, again, I have to reiterate, for comedic reasons, I didn't want to bet. But then what happened was, they fired him. He got fired. Wow. That was in the first, it was the first 13 episodes. And I never wanted him to be fired. But then they said, "Look, when we get to the second series, there'll be a different showrunner." And we got another showrunner, and they just kind of wrote less for me because they thought I was being a bit difficult. But it's interesting that I was always motivated by the comedy of it. For me, I'll do something that's funny. If it's not funny, I'll try and adjust it. And that was such a watershed moment that they fired the showrunner. And I think they had some issues. And we had great people left that show. Do you know Paul Mooney, the guy who just died recently? Yeah. Paul Mooney was the guy who wrote for Richard Pryor. He was one of the writers. He was one of the writers of the Whoopi show. And he was also saying, "We're doing our best for you in the road," but he kept saying, they don't get it. And just have to keep changing things. So I was very lucky that I had Whoopi Goldberg. I think maybe had you had someone who had more of a comic, you would have been saved in that show.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, probably. Yeah, no, I did. I felt very alone and isolated, really. And I think you're probably better at, you know, dealing with. I would just act mad, really. So that got me fired.
But Whoopi was fucking right, though, man. Brown people, especially Middle Eastern people, 30 years behind at least in terms of representation in Hollywood and film and TV. It's insane. Like, there's always progress is happening, always, and things are getting better, but then we'll take sudden, like, gigantic leaps backwards, and it's still accepted to have these ridiculous stereotypes portrayed over and over again. I always say there's only two types of Arabs you see on TV. There's the one who's like in front of a crumbled, broken down house going, "My family, my home, it's destroyed. Everything's destroyed." And then the other one is like, "We have four demands. I want the helicopter. I want the Plaza Hotel penthouse suite." And like, those are the two Arabs that get, you don't just have a normal fucking Arab. And when you see in a film or a TV show, just an Arab person who's just there, for me, it's like,
elation. It's such a massive deal. I celebrate it. I hold it up high. Like, it's happened so rarely. I can count them on one hand where you just see an Arab character just being there with no sympathy sob story or with no fucking agenda that's evil or something or some weird twist stereotype added onto them. And growing up, that's why Alexi mentioned it earlier, so I have to bring it up. That's why you were such a big deal to me growing up, Omid, was just, and I know, and you're not even a fucking Arab, but like seeing I'm you do Arab. Your character in your stand-up, and me as a kid seeing this on telly as a huge comedy fan, me and my dad would sit and watch comedy shows. He'd let me stay up late and watch comedy shows all the time. And then when you started showing up on telly, doing your belly dancing and your crazy, you know, which stuff which you don't do anymore, but stuff that we would do at home as a laugh, it meant such a big deal. And it made me think, oh, maybe there's a career in this for me, which so far hasn't been proven.
I wish you'd been a producer on my quiz. I did a quiz show for my sins, Alexi.
Did you?
A daytime
fucking
quiz show.
Hell.
And you know what? They dressed me in this gray suit. And I swear, half the show was me joking that I looked like a negotiator during the Suez Crisis. And I was going around saying, the British have a lot to be desired with the boats, wallahi. And there were so many jokes from the show. If you ever, it's got a second series. I'm actually in Suffolk. I moved to Suffolk because, you know, I'm making so little money now. I've had to move to Suffolk. And I'm on ITV daytime. And if we get a second series, I joke that because I'm in Ipswich now. And if we get a second series, I have to move to Lowestoft. There's a third series, I'll have to go in the sea.
I like Ipswich, nice town.
Ipswich is a great place, but that's the challenge for me. That when you get older, they offer you more and more super mainstream things, and the thing is, you try and it was called Winning Combination.
Yeah,
and actually, the ITV have now told the production company that they can't keep cutting the jokes. I'd say it's you're a winning combination, Hitler. A bunker and a cyanide pill. That is a winning combination. Donald Trump, the White House, and a removals van. That is a winning combination. So there are all these non-daytime gags right. that were thrown in. But my God, this is the only thing I worry about is that I'm talking to my great hero, the father of alternative stand-up. And now here's me fronting an ITV daytime show. I've become the king of 3 p.m.
No judgment on podcast.
I know, but I'm the king of 3 p.m. and I'm doing it because there's nothing beats reading out a question saying, who played James Bond in Quantum of Solace? And the woman goes, Craig David. And when stuff like that happens, for comedy reasons, you have to do this show. So my question to you, have you not been offered, because you did all these BBC shows, have you not been offered something ridiculously mainstream and just thought, I'll try it? You must have been offered something ridiculous.
No, I don't think so. I think that I can't. No, I don't. I think maybe it's so long ago since I was really, in the kind of center of show business. I think that No, I mean, there must have been stuff in the past, really, maybe, failed pilots, but
If you've done Holby City, or was it Holby City or Casualty?
I've done both, in fact.
You've done that. Were you not offered EastEnders or something? Because I was offered
EastEnders. No, I've not. And I wouldn't. I don't think I'd do that soapier soap. I don't.
What about game shows? I never saw you as a contestant on things. Did you make
it? No, I did a couple of. I think I'm not comfortable with it, really. So I don't, I don't put myself forward for it. But, I did a couple of Have I Got News for Yous when in the Angus era.
Right, as a contestant.
As one of the panellists, but they've never asked me. I think because I was too associated with Angus. And then I think they maybe asked me a couple of times. And I think I said I wanted. It was when they offered me it. Have I Got News for You a couple of times when that was Alistair Campbell was kind of rebuilding his career from war criminal to TV personality. And I said, look, if you're going to have somebody like Alistair Campbell on, I need to know beforehand. And because I'll fucking kill the cunt. He's a big lad. He could probably batter me to death, but I would at least try and attack him. So And I think that they, you know, they balked at me saying I can't, you know, I can't be on with somebody like that. So I think they just forget it, really. So I did Question Time once.
Oh, yeah.
Just to see what it was like.
I always wondered if you'd done Question Time. What year did you do it?
I did it once, and I actually said, they asked some question, and I said, I really don't care about this, which nobody had ever said before. I said, this is stupid. And I didn't really. The thing about Question Time is that you have to have an opinion about everything. You know, shipping part. Actually, when you go to Australia, have you been to Australia and you end up on that their version of Question Time?
Yes.
I found myself talking at great length about Australian coal policy, a subject which I obviously know nothing, because I was in Australia. I didn't care, so I was talking with tremendous authority about the kind of pros and cons of importing coal or solar panels. I didn't care. But so you end up on their version of Question Time, just talking about stuff you have no knowledge of. And I did Question Time once and I thought, nah, this isn't for me, really. I can't take any of this shit seriously, really. So that's our final sort of point. You talked about that you sort of turn your back on acting and that, and that you think you seem to be saying that you thought that stand-up was sacrosanct and that's what you wanted to do from now on primarily. So that's a similar epiphany to what I had. I think that, you know, for all the other stuff that I've done and still do to a degree, but that I realized in the sort of early 2011, 2012, that I turned my back on stand-up for 17 years, and it was and I was ready to come back to it. And that stand-up, in a way, if you can do it, is the, this is self-serving, but it is the greatest thing, really. If you can do stand-up, then you can take as much time off as you want, but in the end, you have to do it, I think. If you're a good stand-up, then it's such a magical thing to do that you must do it, I think.
I think so, and I've come to that conscious decision over the years, because when you go into showbiz, you do everything that they ask you to do, but I focus more on stand-up because it's meaningful to me. I've recently been doing stand-up in the Persian language, which has been a very interesting thing. And then I realized there are huge sensitivities that I wasn't aware of by getting into it. Like with the government they have that's so brutal, the people have become very, very politically correct. So any jokes about the other, like there used to be regional jokes, like if there's a joke about the equivalent of Scousers, for example, in Iran, people who like to steal, you can't do that joke. If there's a town that is connected to homosexuality, you can't do those jokes. So I remember in Persian, there was on a show, they cut this bit out, but they said, you can't say that kind of thing. And I said, if I was a stand-up in Iran, and there aren't, because they can't do this kind of joke.
Yeah.
But if I was a stand-up in Iran, I'd say it's interesting that there's so much political correctness. You can't do jokes about gays or towns associated with homosexuality. And yet they're executing gays every day. So, and they said, you can't do that. You can't do that kind of joke. And I thought, wow, I began to realize.
This was on British telly.
No, this is on an Iranian satellite show, which is filmed in London and only picked up in a couple of households in Iran. So even then they were censoring it. So the point I'm trying to say, I realize the freedoms, and I really appreciate the freedoms we have as stand-ups here. And I just thought I would like to be able to bring that kind of freedom to do stand-up in the Persian language, because A, it's a big part of me, and I've kind of, because I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i, which is a persecuted minority, and it would be a huge thing if I did do stand-up for Iran, because they've not had any Baha'is on television there since the revolution. But also it would be meaningful to me to try and see if I can bring all the skills I've learned from Western stand-up and apply them to the Persian language.
Right.
And that would be hugely meaningful. So for me now, and there's an offer for me to do my own kind of chat show in the Persian language. Possibly.
So this is on like a satellite channel that beams into Iran?
Would be on BBC Persia. So BBC Persia is the main channel in Iran.
Yeah.
So this would be beamed into people's homes. And then they've got a massive platform. It's about 40 million people.
Presumably the Ayatollahs, I mean, is it illegal to listen to it or watch it?
No,
or?
It's not. It would be legal. And if BBC Persia want to put it out, they'll put it out. So,
yeah.
But it has to be appropriate. It has to be funny. And I find that the way my life has gone and just the kind of person I've become, I only like to do things with meaning. So stand-up has become, of all the other things I'm doing, maybe doing a documentary, but things like films and things have become less important. Unless, of course, it's a lead part in a big movie that you really believe in. Mm. Yeah, sure, I'll do that. But I realize that you don't lose, you don't lose your skills for acting if you haven't acted for a couple of years. You just have to maybe do a couple of things to refresh. But in general, stand-up has become so meaningful to me that I can't really do anything else. So that's why I'm focusing on it now. And I think I've come to that same conclusion that you have, that it seems to be the only thing with meaning and integrity that I could do from now on until I die. I think it's the most important thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it is. It's a privilege as well. And it's also, and this is one of the, I mean, it's one of the things that although it was funny, the stupid fucking twatting conservative MP trying to cancel me, you know, there is a sacred role for the stand-up. We are the ones who, you know, the safety valves, and we are the ones who point out the emperor's not wearing any clothes. And
exactly, yeah.
If we lose that, if we're censored, then, you know, the country is really, I mean, it's pretty fucked as it is, but it's going to be even more fucked, really, you know. It's a very chilling direction I think we're going in, really.
I think you should finish it on that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, Alexi, that was Omid. There we go.
Yeah, what an amazing guy. What an amazing conversation.
I really enjoyed that.
And we didn't really get to, we'll have to get him back because we didn't get, you know, his Baha'i faith is very, is fascinating, really. And we didn't really get into his, also, you know, how he got into the business and all that stuff. So.
And yet we spent 15 minutes on Brian Sewell.
Brian Sewell. Well, you know, I think that's the, you know, if, you know, as we accommodate ourselves to the nature of podcasts, I think we go, you know, we go where the conversation takes us, don't we, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to have to look up who Brian Sewell is, but I think I gathered enough from that.
Well, he was also, of course, yeah, he was also the boyfriend of Anthony Blunt, who was the fourth man. Ask your granddad.
Okay, not the third man?
No, the fourth man.
Okay.
If you watch that, there's an episode of The Crown, which is also about who was the fourth man. Anthony Blunt was the something like the Queen's keeper of paintings. There's also a very good Alan Bennett play called The Question of Attribution, which also is about Anthony Blunt.
Okay. All right. Got some homework.
So there you go. Yeah.
That was wonderful. Yeah. That was so cool. And it's such a, like, I think I was gushing enough in that. I'll stop.
Definitely. I'm starting to get, you know, I don't know whether to, you know.
Oh, sorry.
You know, I don't want you getting too much attention, you know. Yeah, it's always on the knife edge. You know, if I see that you're getting popular, it'll be.
Oh. But why? This is supposed to help enhance my career, not be the end of a non-career.
You'd be like little Jody. You'd be gone after 2 days.
No! Okay, well, before that happens, I got to just say thank you to everyone who's signed up to the Patreon already. Do you remember that was a thing? Our Patreon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. It's the way of preventing adverts ever infiltrating this show and helping us, you know, helping fund the show, because as we all know,
stopping me moaning about how I'm paying for everything.
As much as you like hearing him moan, like, he'll have lots of things to moan about, don't worry. So many people have signed up and leaving comments and messages as well, like, thank you, Rusty, so Claire, the Nomad Coder, Michael, Dave, Brendan, Chris, Mark, and Pip. I didn't realize there's actually the ability to, like, leave comments and send messages through the Patreon, which is a nice substitute for the emails as well. I just, like, the Nomad Coder said, I'd like to just say, after some bad luck with purchases, I'm delighted to have been promised absolutely nothing and received absolutely nothing compared to other experiences where I was promised something and received nothing. It's top stuff. So, yes, there is a promise of a firm nothing from the Patreon, but please go and support. Yeah, we get so many lovely messages. Thank you, Conrad. You got so much love out there, Alexei.
Yes, well, it came in handy this last week as well. Fucking hell.
It means a great, great deal. And we've been going long enough, so we're going to end it there, right, Alexei?
I think that's a good idea. I'm exhausted.
Yeah? All right, then.
that's very soft landing. By podcast standards, isn't it, really? It's not. Hey, that's great. I'm good, you know. Hey,
no, we just need a nice punchy goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye. We do the you know, do
and the music the comes in.
Yeah. This has been the Alexisel Podcast. Produced and edited by Talal Karkouti for now. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing and to Audio Boom for hosting us. That'll do. Goodbye.
I tell you should have stayed in Spain, Lovejoy. By the way, who's the bird what answered the phone? Sounds like a right tough.
She is. Real class. You've heard me speak of her, Lady Jane Felsham.
My old man ran a dog called Lady Jane. Won a right wad on her, he did, yeah. Anyway, she says, can you come and shift your commode? What's the problem then, eh? Plumbing gone, has it? Bit of trouble with the old washer.
The commode happens to be an antique, Freddy. It's the only thing I've got left to punt out after the mess you left me in. It also happens to be worth the 20 grand you heard me talking about on the phone.
20 grand for a car, see?